God shall run. There can be no power greater anywhere beneath the sun. Yet what force on earth is weaker than the feeble strength of one? But the Union makes us strong.
Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. For the Union makes us strong.
It is we who plowed the prairies, built the cities where they trade, dug the mines and built the workshops, endless miles of railroad laid. Now we stand outcast and starving mid the wonders we have made, but the Union makes us strong.
Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. For the Union makes us strong.
They have taken on toll.
That's the late folk singer and activist Pete Seeger with Solidarity Forever, which is considered organized labor's anthem or fighting song. It was written in 1915 by Ralph Chaplin for the Industrial Workers of the World, a radical labor union founded in Chicago in 1905, which was vehemently opposed to what it called union class collaboration with the capitalist system. Soon, other unions and workers' movements all over the world adopted Chaplin's anthem as their own. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Tuesday, September the 1st, 2015, and today we're talking about labor pains, not the kind that you're accustomed to hearing about, but the labor pains for approximately 137,000 workers. And this has to do with current negotiations between the Auto Workers Union and Detroit's Big Three. It's 6 weeks since the United Auto Workers Union began hardball negotiations with Detroit's Big Three, General Motors Company, Ford Motor Company, and Fiat Chrysler Automobiles U.S., over a slew of issues related to a new contract for some 137,000 workers. The current contract expires on September the 14th, and with no agreement yet struck on top grievances, among them a two-tiered wage system that pays workers hired after 2007 about half what senior workers earn, union members have voted to authorize a strike against all three manufacturers in the event of bad faith negotiations. Our guest today, and we're fortunate to have him, is Frank Hammer. He's a retired 32-year GM worker and former chairman and president of the UAW's 3,500-member Local 909 in Warren, Michigan. He was in that post for 12 years. He's going to be taking us behind the current negotiations, but with an extraordinarily militant view. And that is, he is going to be telling us that, in his opinion, the union leadership had been capitulating to the dictates of the auto industry for more than a decade now. Frank Hammer is a writer of labor issues, and he has published in many left-leaning and labor publications. He has been involved for many years in local, national, and international workers' rights activisms and programs, and he is a Detroit resident. And I'm delighted to welcome you, Frank, to Lead Stories today. Thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me, Chris. Thank you.
Well, let's start with what's happening now. The negotiations are going on. We have the most recent development being the vote by several of the locals of a strike authorization, which means that they're beginning to suspect that things are not going to work out the way they want to. Could you talk about what is at issue here? What are the top issues that are likely to cause a problem in negotiating and coming to some terms before September the 14th?
Sure. Let me explain a little bit about the strike authorization vote. This is a procedure that is done in advance of the conclusion of negotiations. It is something that is required so that the leadership has the authorization in the event that there is a need for a strike, that they already in advance have that authorization. And it's very very interesting that overwhelming majorities, we're talking about in the 90% and more, that are authorizing the UAW to take a strike, go on strike if necessary. So the leadership should be feeling very good about the support. I find it somewhat ironic that as the rank and file that the three companies have been voting to authorize a strike, that Dennis Williams, the president of the UAW, has announced to the corporate press that our members don't want to go on strike. This is a curious message to present to the companies at this moment in time, especially with such overwhelming authorization to go on strike. So to go to your question, one of the issues that has been uppermost has been the circumstances in each of the companies to one extent or another, where there are multiple tiers of workers who are working in the facilities, some of them at the wage, the what you described as senior workers, that amounts to maybe $28, $30 an hour. And then we have several other tiers. The second tier that you spoke of, we will be making somewhere in the range right now of $16 to $19 an hour. But we also know that there's other workers working in the factories that are making less. And there are even some temporary workers, contract workers, that I've heard that actually are even working at minimum wage at an $8 an hour. So you have a very, very fractured workforce. And one of the key demands that workers have expressed is the desire to eliminate these fractures, eliminate these tiers, and make the workers equal once again as we once were in the Big Three.
Well, just that item alone suggests that something went a little awry in 2007 when these terms were agreed to. What was the lead up to that agreement?
Well, the it actually, 2007, you're right, but there was even a proceeding in 2005 at the spinoffs that General Motors and Ford and Chrysler had. For example, GM spun off its whole Delphi division into an independent company, and they already introduced two-tier in 2005 at Delphi. So to go to General Motors, it was introduced in 2007. It's very important to point out this was before the financial crisis. And I remember the logic. And the logic that was used at the time was you either, this is the company speaking to the UAW leadership, you either accept lower wages for certain kinds of workers in the factory, or we will outsource the work and we'll outsource it to non-union plants, and then you can have, you know, you can go at organizing those non-union plants and see how well you do. And the UAW took the low road and said, okay, we'll accept two-tier wage structures so long as they remain in the UAW. And that's kind of the logic of what led to that event taking place at Delphi and then at GM. Mm.
At the time that these terms were agreed to, was the leadership of the union seen as capitulating, or was the leadership seen as making the best of a bad situation?
Probably a little bit of each. You have to keep in mind that the senior workers who were confronted with, you accept the second tier. Well, the second tier workers were not hired yet. So the second tier workers who came in after the fact, of course, had no vote on it. And I think the senior workers thought that was the best deal that they could get under the circumstances. But surely there were some that saw it as an attack on a fundamental union principle, which, by the way, I really appreciate the playing of the Solidarity Forever, because it was an attack on solidarity by the creation of two-tier. And I think that some people understand that it was a regrettable turn for the UAW. But I do want to add one note. What's clear is that the company's demands for multi-tier wages is part of a model that is being used globally. It was sold to UAW members as, this is the way that we can become more competitive. This is the way we can retain more jobs in the U.S. But the reality is that they're using two tiers everywhere. So, for example, we know that they're using a two-tier, multiple-tier structures in places like Colombia and a GM plant there outside Bogota. We know that they're using them in Brazil. And for example, in southern Brazil. And we know that they're even using two-tier at a General Motors facility in India, the birthplace of the caste system. And at a Hello plant in the state of Gujarat in India, they have two-tier. And the senior workers are making 92 cents an hour, and the second tier are making 47 cents an hour. And you have to wonder how General Motors convinced the Indian workers that in order to save their jobs and to be competitive, they had to accept two-tier there. But they did. It's a model of labor relations that works very well for General Motors and cripples our unions.
How has this? I mean, this went on in 2007 when that contract actually ushered in and entrenched the two-tier system. What was the response from organized labor?
I think it was some kind of, we have to accept this. If the UAW didn't mount a resistance, the other unions, for example, and the AFL-CIO and the Federation would line up behind UAW because that's a UAW turf, and they were very muted. And it's very muted today, that two-tier has spread like a virus, and you begin to see it in so many different workplaces. And the underlying theory of it, and the reason why there's some acceptance of it by the labor movement, is that the view is that we overpriced ourselves, and we were not able to organize in the South. All the southern plants, whether they be Toyota, Nissan, VW, they're all non-union. And the UAW had the idea that somehow we were going to lift up the workers in the South to the standards of the UAW in the North, which we did for a time. But unable to organize in the South by 2009, after the bankruptcy, the UAW was told, well, now you will not be lifting up the VW workers and the Nissan workers, Toyota workers up to the level, our level. we're going to take you down to the level of the non-union workers. And that's what happened in 2009. And that was under a Democratic administration, that was under Obama, and I think the labor movement has been very muted on this whole question.
2007, I keep bringing up this year, 2007, was literally placed the movement, the auto workers and the unions, on the cusp of a devastating downfall in the automobile industry. Was it seen at the time as a way of kind of blunting the what was to come, which was, you know, you just referred to it, massive layoffs, and indeed many automobile companies went under, and some had to be, quote, saved. We'll get to that in a minute. But in 2008, could you talk about how this move, which was a very, very strategic move to put in place this two-tier system in an atmosphere where people were afraid of the, you know, the job loss, the hemorrhaging of jobs, the pending bankruptcy of the automobile industry generally, it was rife throughout the industry, and there was great fear that as many as 2 million jobs would be lost if something wasn't done in a radical way to basically rein in what you call the overpricing of labor at that point. What was the role of the Obama administration at this point?
So I do want to mention that in terms of the earlier comment that you were making, that already in 1982 was the beginning of the union, the UAW, approaching management and responding to the demand for concessions. And, you know, I mean, concessions became a decades-long strategy for keeping the plants running and for keeping employment levels high in the auto industry. So this has been a strategy. And in exchange for concessions, the idea was that we were going to get job security. And over the decades, that proved to be fruitless. We declined from from 1.5 million members to 400,000. And for example, at General Motors, where I worked, when I hired in, there were 425,000 members. And I think we're down now to 50,000. It's very dramatic what's happened in spite of all the concessions that were made by the UAW. And the UAW can take pride in saying, well, we still have 50,000 by virtue of all the concessions that were made. So moving forward now to the question you asked about Obama, I look at what happened in 2008 as a page out of the book written by Naomi Klein on the shock doctrine. And the bankruptcy that came on the heels of the financial crisis in Wall Street was nothing more than Wall Street and the bankers and the corporate boards, the board of directors, taking advantage of a situation, taking advantage of a crisis, which is what shock doctrine is all about. And the workers were confronted with the shock that their companies could literally decline and fold. And in that moment of shock, two-tier had already been in place, but it was etched into stone as a result of the bankruptcy bailout. But there were many other things that were lost by auto workers that had taken decades to win, including cost of living, including overtime premiums, including there's just a whole host of takeaways that took place when the bankruptcy bailouts occurred for both GM and for Chrysler.
The Obama administration threw in a lot of money to save the industry on the argument that, you know, there was much more to lose than just the companies. There was, you know, the economy itself was going to reel if the auto industry were to collapse, and they came in with quite a bit of money and bailed out the auto industry. But something curious happened there, too, in terms of taking advantage of a crisis situation. What happened?
Well, I think that that's the other side of the coin. And we know that there are voices, especially from senators like Senator Shelby in the South, who went on a rampage about let the companies go down, let the companies down, go down. Of course, he was had a self-interest in that because he had only 9 union plants in the South, and they were just fine. You had Mitt Romney, who was credited with a headline of let Detroit go. And I think that was a debate, that we represented as a debate among the elites about whether we should just do away with all the auto companies that are infected with the union virus, or whether we should let these companies stand and we would just tailor the unions more to our liking. And that argument is the one that won out, not the one that said, let it go, because there were some cooler heads that prevailed that said, well, if we let it all go, it will just crash our economy, and we can't do that. So the next best thing is to revamp the union, the UAW, so that it becomes a real partner to the company. And coming out of that 2009 bankruptcy, that's in fact what happened. And the way this was made crystal clear is that the following year at the UAW Constitutional Convention in Detroit, none other than the governor of the state of Michigan, Granholm, Jennifer Granholm, a Democrat, came to the convention, was one of the first featured speakers, mm-hmm. and spoke of the UAW as parting from its bad past habits of engaging in fights with the company and going forward as a provider of good labor skills, of skilled labor. And that was a defining moment in 2010 and going forward. That has been the UAW's role, not to fight with the companies, but to provide the companies with good skilled labor.
The companies facing bankruptcy got a lot of money to stay afloat. I want to focus on what happened at Chrysler, for example. What happened there? And how did this money, this infusion of government money, both bail Chrysler out, as well as GM and others, but also set up a very interesting opportunity for, I would say, foreign commerce, where the idea was to bail out the U.S. auto industry, but we find that, in fact, the Obama administration actually financed the takeover of an American company by an Italian company. Could you talk about that a bit?
Yes, I have to confess, I'm a little less familiar with the circumstances going on at Chrysler, but I think the point that you made is a very good point. I do want to add that one of the things that came to the fore during this period was the call for nationalization of the auto company, especially, like, for example, GM, which, by the way, the U.S. ultimately, it was $10 billion that the taxpayers paid for that bailout. And there was a call for nationalizing the company, and the government was now the major shareholder and could have steered the company, General Motors, in a direction that, for example, would have been much more friendly to the environment, would have been much more addressing the question of getting off of fossil fuels, going into hybrids, going into more forcefully into electric car production, et cetera. And the Obama administration, basically was a hands-off policy. We leave it to the company to do what it wants. But in the course of that, it cost the taxpayers $10 billion to keep the company afloat. So to go back to your question about Chrysler, I wish I could get to you in more detail, but the essential point that you made is, yeah, we facilitated the takeover of the, which essentially was a U.S. company. by an Italian manufacturer, Fiat.
But at the same time, did this actually increase employment? As the government had contended up until that point that the reason for the mass infusion was to save jobs, American jobs, and to create even more jobs. Did that actually happen?
Yeah, I believe that there was some increased job creation. Of course, with the second tier, and by the way, Fiat Chrysler has, I think, 40% of the workforce that now is second tier, paying such lower wages for auto workers. And by the way, the new hires don't have the health care that the senior workers have. They don't have the pensions. All they have is a 401k. So under those circumstances, the companies have come to recognize that it's becoming profitable to now produce cars at these lower wages and these lower benefits. And so there has been some additional work that has come back to that's in the U.S. plants. But I want to remind you that today we're at a total of 130,000 between Ford, General Motors, and Chrysler. When I hired in 1975, there were 425,000 workers at GM alone. So it's a very, very big difference. And the comeback, even after the bankruptcy, is nowhere near what our employment was before that. But there were some jobs that did get created with a new structure of wages and benefits.
But again, those new jobs that have been created, for the most part, they're earning less and they're getting fewer benefits than before.
Correct. And the question, coming back to the negotiations, is will this be changed, and will workers or second tier achieve parity with the senior workers? And by the way, I want to add that the senior workers have had their wages held and frozen for approximately 9 years, and they're more antsy than ever about asking the question, well, what about a raise for us? And by the way, one of the things that was lost during the bankruptcy, to point out again, is the issue of cost of living. So that we won the cost of living back in the 70s after a 100-day strike. And the intention of cost of living was to maintain within the rate of inflation. That was lost with the stroke of a pen during the bankruptcy bailout. So the question of what's going to happen for the senior workers is also on the table. And, of course, I think overarching is the maintaining continuation of employment at the auto companies. And what I want to say in regards to that is the UAW, in this age of globalization, has not embarked on building the kind of international solidarity that we need to tackle companies that are global.
Could you talk a bit more about that? Could you explain that, Frank? Could you go into that particular statement a little bit more?
Sure. So we're today living in a globalized economy, and what that means for auto workers is that General Motors has factories all over the world, and the UAW prefers to keep blinders and not look outside our borders to what are the conditions that workers in other factories, for General Motors factories in other parts of the world, what are those conditions? And if General Motors maintains those kind of conditions elsewhere, what impact will those have on U.S. workers? And so, for example, I was mentioning earlier that we have a GM plant in India that pays 92 cents, 47 cents an hour, two-tier. No benefits, and many, many workers are getting injured and getting fired. And by the way, that's another thing that I've discovered about General Motors, is that their model is elsewhere to use workers up, to exhaust them, to work them to the point of injury, to get rid of them, and to get more workers, young workers. And so we have a choice as a union, and we have a choice as the UAW going forward and saying, we cannot tolerate General Motors treating other members of the working class, whether they be in Colombia, in India, or Brazil, in this manner, and think that we are somehow going to sustain our level or our standards. We're seeing in front of our very eyes that the companies are taking down the U.S. workforce because they're able to, because of what they're doing overseas.
So, go ahead. So what does this mean for the average person? What should the response be?
Well, I've been very much involved in supporting the workers in the other GM facilities abroad. And the particular example is the workplace in Colombia, the GM assembly plant where they assemble Chevy Sparks, not for export to the United States. The Sparks that are here come from South Korea, but they export for the local market in Colombia. And the workers have been injured in the hundreds because of very dismal working conditions. And they have routinely been dismissed and fired by the company. And some workers decided to take a stand and say, no, this is not, this is, we cannot accept this. Because if we're injured and out of work and not even getting compensation, we will not be able to provide for our family. So they took a stand. This occurred approximately 4 years ago. And 4 years later, they are still struggling, and they have maintained a tent encampment in front of the U.S. Embassy in Bogota. And they have solicited support from workers everywhere. And what's begun to happen over this period of time is that there are workers now in Brazil, there are workers here in the United States, there are workers in Germany who are rallying to their cry and lending support for their struggle, because they understand if the GM continues to get away with firing injured workers there, it's just a matter of time before that escalates and begins to happen more in the U.S. and in the other developed countries. So it really goes to go back to your solidarity forever. We have to understand that the solidarity can't no longer be a national phenomenon. It has to be international. And we have to reach out to workers who are suffering to a greater degree than even we are.
Frank, could you talk about the significance and importance of the auto industry to workers? I mean, what has the auto industry offered workers over the years?
Well, I think that when the UAW basically had the whole industry unionized, and I'm talking again about the big three, it's a different question entirely with the question of suppliers, but it basically had all the workers organized, represented by the UAW. And as a result, there was sort of a level playing field at the negotiating table, and the companies knew that the UAW could shut them down and interfere with their production, and that's where our power came from. And as a result, we auto workers really had a terrific standard of living without any question. We had health care, although the union, the UAW, forsook going after single-payer health care back in the 50s and agreed to go to health care employer by employer. But nevertheless, we had a wonderful healthcare system, healthcare into retirement. As I mentioned, we set the standard for wages. We had great benefits, et cetera. So we were in a terrific mode up to the 70s and into the early 80s. And I think that as globalization grew and expanded and so on, is when you began to see the gains that were made by our union erode. But for a time, you know, we set the standard of we set the standard for the country. We set the standard that many, many workers enjoyed a good standard of living. We're able to send their kids to college, you know, skilled trades. Many of them had cottages up north. Then, you know, so we had it great. But the world has changed, and we have not kept up with that change.
Could I impose upon you a bit and ask you to just give us an idea from your own personal travel through your job at in the auto industry? What did it do for you?
Well, I think that over and beyond the things that I just expressed about in general, which did have a positive impact on me, it was my workplace in Warren, Michigan, was a place that was very important from the point of view of building the solidarity of the working class movement. And the reason I say that is because that is where, on a day-to-day basis, workers of different nationalities rubbed elbows and got to, you know, we built cars. We built, in my plan, we built parts for cars. We built transmissions for cars. And it was a very important place for, in my region of the world, which is one of the most segregated in the whole country, that is to say Detroit and its suburbs, that it was a place where people really broke down any stereotypes and broke down any differences and recognized that we were one. And that was a very important feature of working class life in my factory. And as these factories have closed, I'm concerned that a kind of solidarity that was built in the factories disappears. And that we've become more segregated and we've become more in competition with each other rather than in solidarity and collaboration with each other. So that's one of the things that I would say it did for me and that I think it did for workers in general. It helped our solidarity as workers.
This two-tiered system, has it become a kind of racial divide as well, as a pay divide?
Well, you know, I've been out of the plant for a while, but I have not. That's not been expressed to me by the second tier workers or the first tier workers. And in fact, you might want to say this: that in the past, companies found other ways to create tiers. They created tiers as between men and women. They created tiers as between the white majority and minorities, and black workers specifically. And as these things were declared illegal, as they were challenged, the company had to come up with some kind of a new way to create tiers. And so it found a way by virtue of your date of hire. And I have not heard it challenged either on the grounds of sexual discrimination or on the basis of racial discrimination, but it is a discrimination nevertheless. It has not somehow not been challenged legally in a court. So they found a way to create tiers without being in violation of laws banning discrimination in hiring and promotions and so on. So I have not heard that's been the way it's fallen out.
Has there been a challenge brewing among the rank and file to the leadership?
I've not heard of it. I know that it's very much on workers' minds, but I've not heard of a legal challenge to this new setup. So that's a very good question. Maybe that's what auto workers ought to be entertaining. That maybe this is a new form of discrimination that has to be challenged on some legal ground. But I've not heard of it done yet.
As the talks continue, what are you hearing about the main sticking points here, other than the two-tier and other than a general raise in pay? What other issues are on the table?
Well, I know, for example, a concern by many workers, especially at Chrysler, has to do with work schedules. And the work schedules that were agreed to by the national parties mandates that the companies can have what they call three crews, two shift operations. And it means that you have one crew that might work Monday through Thursday on days. You might have another crew that works on afternoons, Tuesdays through Friday. And then you have another group that works two afternoons over the weekend and 2 days the following week on day shift. And these three crew, two shift operations have been a real challenge for workers in regards to their family life and their personal life and their social life. And I know that that's been a real sticking point among many Chrysler workers, that they find themselves, for example, compelled to work through holidays. It was an issue about that they were somehow going to have a mandatory work day on July 4th, for example. So I know that this is another concern, and that it is coming a lot from among Chrysler workers. There are also issues about consolidation of skilled trades work. There's been a radical diminishment of the skilled trades workforce. And I know that that was an issue in 2011. 2011, by the way, workers were restricted from exercising their right to strike. 2015 will be the first time again that workers will be able to exercise the right to strike if they they push the leadership in that direction. Legally, they're in a position to do it.
So the fact that the auto industry seems to be rebounding, you know, sales are up, and of course revenues are up. Is it coincidental that the new contract negotiations are pressing harder because there is more money available, and therefore they want to make up for lost time?
The common view, I think, among auto workers, especially at GM and Chrysler, but as well as Ford, is that it's by virtue of their sacrifices that were imposed during the bankruptcy bailout that the companies have rebounded, and that the companies are now making what one friend of mine called obscene profits. They are making profits hand over fist. They are making billions. And I think the workers rightfully are saying, it's due to our sacrifices that you have returned to such great profitability in North America. And now it only makes sense that we recoup some of our losses. Now, what the UAW leadership has said is, yes, the workers deserve a reward. But that's not the same thing. When they say that the workers need to be rewarded for their efforts, they're talking about maybe having a big bonus payment. But they're not talking about restructuring the contract to make it look more like it used to look before the bailout. So it would be a bonus, maybe, that the UAW is contemplating with the companies, but not a restructuring, not a winning back of the COLA benefit, or not a winning back of a full pension for second-tier workers. That's what's at issue. And the workers are saying, we made our sacrifice. We made you successful. You are very profitable. You can now afford to bring us up to par. And, of course, the companies are going to resist that like crazy.
I wanted to ask this question earlier. While the industry, the auto industry, was going through its fiscal crisis, the city of Detroit also was beginning to reverberate because of the auto industry taking a nosedive. What has been the relationship between the auto industry of Detroit and the city and people of Detroit?
Yeah.
And do you see any impact at all transferring from what happened to the auto industry to what eventually happened to the city of Detroit, which, according to many of the guests that we have had here, they contend that the city was actually forced into bankruptcy?
Yeah, I think that, I mean, so I'm an auto worker and I live in Detroit. So I've seen there's obviously a direct connection between the fate of the industry and the fate of Detroit. And I would add that, going back to the concept of the shock doctrine, that once the auto companies were at the brink of bankruptcy, and I want to remind you that the reason that happened is because the financial crisis caused the automobile markets to deflate from a 17 million car sale year to 10 million. And under the circumstances, you know that there were going to be a lot of factories that were going to close, and they did. So because the companies are trying to retain profits, and the way to do that is on the backs of the workers, and so they closed all these factories. So what effect has the closure of these factories had on a city that is the auto mecca of the world? And of course, it had a huge impact. And there are numerous factories in the area, in the city and in the region that closed and never reopened. And as a result, the unemployment levels in Detroit were very high, up to 50%. And with a loss of jobs, it was figured out that during the first decade of the 21st century, 200,000 people left Detroit. The city lost a fifth of its population. So between the population loss, the job loss, it was inevitable that the city could not have the revenue to sustain the city that, by the way, is 139 square miles big. And so this was the second opportunity for the bankers, and the bankers played a terrible role, not only in terms of what happened with mortgage foreclosures and these subprime loans and so on, but the bankers also did the same kinds of loans to the city and put the city in the same situation. So the bankruptcy was inevitable. And it was another, to me, a form of shock doctrine, another opportunity. And we are now seeing the effects of, now that we are through this bailout of the city, in regards to what's happening in the city now, and that is so many public assets now being taken over by private hands, for example, and the city pensioners partially losing in their pensions, but mostly losing in their health care. So the effects have been sweeping, and certainly at the heart of it is the loss of the industry that sustained our city. So we talk about deindustrialization of Detroit, and that's basically what's happened.
But I can't help but notice, of course, that the government, the federal government, were moved aggressively to bail out the industry, but did nothing, really, to bail out the city. What do you think about that?
Well, I think that was really, you could really see that, especially at this moment where we're celebrating the 10th anniversary of Katrina. And that was the shock for New Orleans, of course. And you heard about a huge federal, bailout. I think it was a $50 billion. The figure rings in my mind. And my way of looking at Detroit is that we suffered a Katrina without the water. And there was no bailout.
Wow.
There were some, but not to the magnitude of the crisis. And, you know, I think that I think the view is that, well, this is just the natural operation of the market. And they could not quite say that about New Orleans. So New Orleans were compelled to provide a huge federal bailout. But for Detroit, oh, this is just the operation of the market. This is just business as usual. And there was nobody could see the justification for the bailout that Detroit should have had.
Well, what should all of this mean to the average consumer, to the activist consumer? How should we be reacting at this time to this particular issue of 137,000 workers basically fighting for what they believe to be their rightful benefits?
Well, I would bring everybody's attention to the what are called free trade agreements. And the reason I want to bring that to people's attention is because we are facing looming threats with the upcoming congressional vote on something called the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which has been described as the NAFTA on steroids, the North America Free Trade Agreement on steroids. And the reason I want to bring attention to that is that that and two other international global trade agreements will transform forever our economies and our democracies, because it will make corporations have even more power than they have now to dictate what the consequences for our own lives, and will diminish our democratic rights and democratic say-so, because they're going to put the corporations basically in the driver's seat, and corporations are going to be able to challenge governments in secret tribunals should governments like the U.S. or like Japan want to challenge or impact corporate profitability, and the corporations through these trade agreements will be able to respond and say, you are taking away our profit-making, and we're going to take you to our tribunal. We're going to sue you, and if we're successful, you are going to have to pay us for the profits that we would otherwise have made. So that's looming on the horizon, and I think that while the contract negotiations are very, very important here in September, we should not lose sight of that behind those contract negotiations looms even a bigger threat to our ability to maintain any kind of our standard of living in the United States and prevent it from declining further into what are called third world rates, third world status.
Based on what you're hearing, is a strike possible?
Well, the leadership has made it very clear that they consider a strike a failure. That's how they've framed it. And I think that workers have it on their mind that they may want to go out on strike. But I think the underlying fear is going to be, I don't want to lose my job. Because everybody knows that the job situation currently is not a very good one for working class people. And that fear is going to lurk in workers' hearts when they're confronted with this challenge of demanding back so many things that they lost or changed in two tiers. So I think that what workers need to do in the factories is to really discuss this among themselves. They should be obviously saving money in the eventuality of that there's a strike. But ultimately, it's a question of if we don't expand our horizons and grow our solidarity globally, they're always going to be able to threaten us with our jobs, and that's the challenge that we're confronted with.
And finally, Frank, what do you say to people who say, look, I mean, they're going through their thing, and, you know, that's the auto industry, and that's auto workers, and it really doesn't have very much to do with me. I'm over here trying to make it in my neck of the woods. What is the relationship that the average person should be conscious of between what's going on in the lives of 137,000 people and me?
Well, certainly most immediately in the, for example, in Detroit and in this region, the economy of the region was as good as it was because of what workers were able to win in negotiations and strikes with the auto companies historically. So it's everybody's standard of living. If you were a party store owner, if you were a small business, if you were not directly related to the auto plants, but indirectly, your ability to sustain and to have the kind of life that you want came on the backs of the efforts of workers. And so that people who are not in the auto plants, people who are not in the auto industry, have a connection that they should be mindful of supporting the auto workers. And I can assure you that should there be a strike, that the workers are going to be attacked, you know, in the media, and they're going to be discredited, and look at these greedy auto workers, and so on, which has been done before. But I think people should be mindful that it's because of the workers' struggle that has sustained economies that, you know, we've all enjoyed, and we should be in solidarity with auto workers if and when they actually embark on a strike.
I want to thank you so much, Frank Hammer, for being with us today and being our professor in this area of labor relations in the auto industry as the contract negotiations continue with a September 14th deadline. Thank you so much for giving us the benefit of your knowledge and your expertise and experience today.
Well, I have to thank you for the very challenging questions that you asked me. So I thank you, and it was a good challenge for me to try to see if I could explain some of these few things that I know.
So you did very well. We were in class with you today. Thanks so much again. Stay tuned. Coming up next, The Infectious Myth with David Crowe. You can certainly write me a note. Let me know how this program resonated with you at leadstories@gmail.com. Thank you so much for joining me today. I hope this was informative and lets you think a bit about the connections that we actually have with each other without knowing it or being conscious of it. What does Detroit have to do with you in Connecticut or in Washington, D.C. or in New York City? Well, now you know. Bye-bye.
In our hands is placed a power greater than their hoarded gold, greater than the might of atoms magnified a thousandfold. We can bring to birth a new world from the ashes of the...